my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, I take great pleasure in inviting you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and coming to you live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. After a gap of a week, I'm happy to be back with you. As you all know, I had to skip last week's episode. Thanks to a happy reason, we were doing the next season of the Sai Bhagavatam, Satya to Sai. But I'm here to continue with the Gita series, and what a beautiful day to do that on the eve of Bhagwan's 93rd birthday. And it's so wonderful to go back into the message of the Bhagavad Gita. And as you would be noticing all these while, and as you'll be seeing this week too, we depend immensely on Swami's words to understand better the Bhagavad Gita, and rightly so, because you will see that as we go on deeper and deeper into the study of the Gita, how much resonance is there in Swami's discourses. And even though we may or may not have gone deeply into the Bhagavad Gita text itself, we would realize that much of the concepts we have been fortunate enough to hear directly from Swami himself. We have started the second chapter, and we actually started what we refer to as the real Gita, because it begins from the 10th verse of the second chapter when Krishna starts speaking, and that's the part we went through the last time around, which was a couple of weeks back. We went through only 3 verses in that verse number 10, 11 and 12 of chapter 2. And the reason that we could do only that many was because I wanted to explain and establish the context of the Gita, which is very, very important, especially as we are going through these very profound Vedantic concepts, which Krishna is going to start explaining to Arjuna in the next few verses of the second chapter. And in the absence of the context, the Gita itself may look like a text that promotes violence, because it's going to talk about the fact that nobody dies and nobody is living. So one might think that it's a license to go ahead and involve yourself in a life of crime, and here is spiritual or philosophical justification for that. So to clear that confusion that people sometimes raise about the Bhagavad Gita, is very important to know the context in which the Bhagavad Gita itself is given. So we first went through that verse where Krishna expresses a very subtle emotion, where he gives out a light smile before he begins his discourse. And I explained how that smile appeared a little out of place, because here was Arjuna right in front of him, who was in tears, who was depressed. The entire first chapter is named after his depression. It's called Arjuna Vishad Yoga. That's how depressed Arjuna is. But here is Krishna in front of him. Instead of sympathizing and empathizing with his pain, he's smiling. And I spoke a little about the importance of that smile, because it was not a smile that was condescending or a smile that was making fun or poking fun at Arjuna, but it was a smile of the Lord who is expressing delight at the fact that finally the devotee has come to the point where he says, I surrender. I surrender my reasoning, I surrender my understanding of right and wrong. And that is the significance of Krishna smiling, because that moment is so very important in the journey of a devotee. And Swami has told multiple times how God waits for the devotee to turn to him much, much more. He pines for that moment much, much more than how much a devotee pines for the Lord's grace. So that moment when Arjuna, even though he had this long association with Krishna, Swami explains that he never had a discourse on Vedanta or a discussion on such deep philosophical topics with Krishna, and Krishna never forced a topic into that. This was the first time when Arjuna is saying that, I think I've got it all mixed up. I'm not able to make out what is right and wrong. So Krishna, I'm turning to you. I'm surrendering to you. So the surrender of Arjuna is one of the most important contexts that we have to keep in mind, because here is a noble person who has the opportunity to be close to God because of his nobility, and he is being guided by the Lord. That is a very, very important context. The context of Arjuna's nobility, Arjuna's surrender, and the person in front of him is Yogeshwara Krishna. He is not another individual. He's not a promoter of a religion. He's not a religious head, but he's the Lord himself. So what is being given is the purest form of wisdom, and it is being given to a devotee who is prepared to receive that wisdom, right? Because what Krishna is giving in the form of the supreme wisdom is, as I explained last time, like a sharp knife. And only after he has found Arjuna worthy of handling such a weapon, which could be used or misused in that sense, he is giving it to Arjuna only after he has ascertained that he is a person worthy to be given an instrument as destructive as that. I'm using the word destructive, but I'm saying that because, as Swami would say about the knife itself, the knife is an instrument which is very, very useful to save lives in the hands of a crafty surgeon, but the same knife becomes a weapon of violence in the hands of a miscreant, right? So we should understand that Arjuna has been found to be a qualified worthy surgeon who has been given this sharp knife by Arjuna, by Krishna. So that is a context that we have to always keep in mind, especially when we are going through the next few verses. Why are those next few verses so very important? I'll come to that in the end of the introduction before we go into the verses that we have for today. So the surrender of Arjuna is one context. And thereafter, you know, Krishna now teaches him the wisdom that is what we refer to as prajnana, or the supreme wisdom. That's why I keep repeating this, that Krishna was taking Arjuna from sugnana to prajnana. Sugnana is good knowledge, or knowledge which is combined with goodness. That is the definition I am using. I am not too sure whether that is the universal meaning of the word sugnana, but in certain contexts, Swami has used it like that. Sugnana is the jnana in the hands of a good person, or one person who is ripened by goodness and also has jnana. But that is also not the supreme wisdom. That is why Krishna is raising Arjuna from the state of sugnana to prajnana. And Krishna begins by telling Arjuna that you are speaking words of wisdom, prajnana vadan bhashase, he says. But at the same time, you are worrying about what must not be worried for. Ashochyan anvashochastvam. That is what Krishna tells Arjuna. Ashochyan, this is not worthy of being worried about, or this is not an event that needs to be worried about, and you're worrying about that. And at the same time, you're speaking words of wisdom, which is paradoxical or contradictory to each other. That's how Krishna begins his discourse in this particular part of the Bhagavad Gita. Then Krishna says that all of us, me, you, and all these warriors are going nowhere. Only they may not continue as your uncle, grandfather, and teacher. And a true pandita or a learned one is he who does not feel bad for those who exist or those who leave. Gatasun, those whose life is gone, agatasunscha, and those whose life is still there. Na anushochanti panditaha, those that don't grieve for both is the wise one, is what Krishna tells Arjuna in that first verse, the verse number 10 of chapter 2. We all cry over death because, you know, we begin to miss them, the people who have been taken away from us by death. But as we saw the last time, we don't grieve over those who live abroad and we are not enjoying their company at the present moment. But we know that they continue to live somewhere, right? Even though we've not seen them for many decades, we might not have interacted with them much. But the moment the news comes that so-and-so has passed away, then we start grieving. We don't grieve when we know that that person is not seen, but he continues to live, he or she continues to exist. But somehow this idea of death is making us feel that now that life is ended, or that person has passed away, that person is no more. So that is the understanding that Krishna is attacking at this point in time. He's saying that similarly, when the person goes away from us, we don't necessarily worry about them. Only death makes us grieve. So when people can never not be there, right? That is what Krishna says. When people can never not be there, na chaiva na bhavishyamah sarve Vayamataha Param. It will never happen that we all will cease to exist. That's what Krishna explains to Arjuna. It will never happen that all of us cease to exist. So when that is the case, the act of crying or sorrowing or grieving is an absurd thing to do. But then what is death in that sense? If death is not to be worried about, death is not to be cried about, is there anything that is worthy of being cried for? And what is death if it is not what we think it is to be? Well, that's what Krishna is going to explain in the verses that will be coming. So death is an important discussion in the Gita. Again, because the war is the scenario or the context in which the Gita is being delivered. As I said, the first context is that Arjuna is a good person. Arjuna is a person who has surrendered. But the other important thing is the backdrop of the whole Bhagavad Gita is the war. And the war being the scenario or the context of the Bhagavad Gita makes the discussion on death a very, very important one in the discourse of the Bhagavad Gita. So what Krishna says here can be used by us in general to make ourselves emotionally strong, as we are going to see in the arguments that Krishna will be giving. But it is not to justify any form of violence that is motivated by emotions like anger or hatred. And that's why these verses have a certain purpose in the discourse that Arjuna is receiving from Lord Krishna. And that is very, very beautifully explained by Swami in the Gita Vaini. And in that particular passage, Swami also explains the importance of the verses that we are right now studying, what we did last time and what we will be going through this time too. So I'll just read out those few lines from the Gita Vaini where Swami explains the context of these shlokas, which we should always keep in our mind. So Swami says, Arjuna is afflicted by two types of delusion. One ordinary and two out of the ordinary. To confuse the body with oneself and pine for the body as if something has happened to you is the ordinary delusion. To discard one's own dharma or duty, in this case the duty of a warrior, as not dharma is an out of the ordinary delusion. Krishna destroyed the first and removed the second. Krishna dealt with the first in the verses 12 to 30 of the second chapter. And that's precisely where we are. So these verses 12 to 30 are very, very profound, very deep talks of the Vedantic concept about existence of the soul, of the body, what is life, what is death and all of that. But when one thing is, it is the deep philosophical concept of Vedanta, but it is also to be combined with the concept of dharma. That is why both of these go together. And as Swami so beautifully explains here, Krishna is destroying one and removing the other. That one is being dismantled completely. He's saying that how can you cry? There is no grounds for you to grieve like this. And that is what Krishna is completely breaking down the argument of Arjuna, and that argument itself is so very powerful. I'll try and explain that as we go through the verses today. That argument itself is so very important and relevant to us, but that has to be combined with the idea of doing one's dharma. And that is what makes Bhagavad Gita practical. If we remove one from the other, I think we'll be quoting it out of context and we will be left high and dry in confusion. So that is the kind of an elaborate introduction for today's session, because we had a break last week. I thought we'll just dwell a little more into what we did last week so that we have the continuity, because this is a very, very important part of the Bhagavad Gita, starting from verse 11 to verse 30, as Swami explained here. So we'll start with verse 13, second chapter, verse number 13. We'll listen to Brother Shyam reciting it for us. He so very beautifully and very clearly recorded it for us, and I'm going to play that. He is an alumnus of our university, a regular Vedam teacher on Radio Sai. So I've requested him to record all the verses for us. So I'll play verse number 13, chapter 2, in his voice. After that, I'll give you a brief meaning of that verse, and then we'll discuss about it.
దేహినోస్మిన్ యథా దేహే కౌమారం యౌవనం జరా తథా దేహాంతర ప్రాప్తిః ధీరస్తత్ర న ముహ్యతి.
As the embodied continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The wise one is not bewildered by such a change. So that's the verse number 13 of the second chapter. Krishna explains in this verse that what we refer to as death is just a change, and why this change also should not cause grief. That is the essence of this particular verse. Yes, the people who die may not continue to exist as how they are related to us, as our grandfather, as our cousin, as our teacher in this context, the relatives in front of Arjuna. But they will continue to exist. That is what Krishna is trying to explain here. And Krishna is making a very, very simple comparison. He says, for the Dehi, or the indweller of the body, this is a word we would have heard Swami use innumerable number of times in his discourses. Deha is the body, Dehi is the one who lives in the body. So Krishna says, for the Dehi, the one who is the indweller of the body, the changes of the body, the changes that the body undergoes through Kaumaram, Yavvanam and Jara. Kaumaram is boyhood, Yavvanam is youth, and Jara is old age. So what the body undergoes through Kaumaram, Yavvanam and Jara, and the changes that happens with Dehantara Prapti. Dehantara Prapti means death. I'll explain what it actually means, because it's a very beautiful word which is used. So what change happens from Kaumaram, Yavvanam and Jara is very similar to what happens with Dehantara Prapti, or at the time of death. They are very, very similar. Now that word Dehantara Prapti. Dehantara Prapti means Dehantaram, Deha again, as I said, is a body. And Dehantarana means getting a new body. So Dehantara Prapti means the moment where one gets a new body. Right? That's what the word Dehantara Prapti means. And this is a concept which is absolutely central to the idea of Vedanta, Swami's message, the Sanatan Dharma. The idea that we are a Dehi, an indweller, which moves from one body to another through the process we call death and birth. This is a concept which is very, very important, and much of the confusion that we face when we read scriptural texts comes because of either that we don't believe in this concept that we are an indweller who travels from body to body, or we have not crystallized this idea in our mind. Maybe as we go through the Bhagavad Gita, we will talk a little more about that, why that causes so much confusion. But keep this always in mind. In fact, there are some discourses, I don't have that particular reference today, where Swami clearly says that the belief in the karma system, the belief in the fact that one dies and takes a reincarnation in another body, these are central to Sanatan Dharma or the idea of Vedanta. So Krishna explains here that the changes one undergoes from childhood to boyhood, or as we grow up, and at old age, the body undergoes many transformations. This change is very similar to the transformation that happens to the Dehi after death. Let's try to think of this. You know, the beauty of Vedanta itself is, you know, it takes up concepts which are very easy for us to contemplate on and understand, which we undergo in our everyday life, and it kind of extends that to a much deeper and more profound concept. Take a picture of, say, yourself when you were 3 years old or 4 years old, or maybe even younger, and now look at yourself in the mirror. the bodies have changed so much, right? That body of the 3 or 4 year old is so tender, so gentle and so beautiful and cute. And, you know, you could think of all the adjectives that depict beauty. That's what the 3 or 4 year old is. Well, I'm not saying that all of you have not no more beautiful. I'm just saying that the body changes so much, right? I don't think any of us is as beautiful as we were when we were 3 or 4 years old, however beautiful we are now. So the idea is, when we look at ourselves, a picture of ourselves when we were 3 or 4 years old, that person, that body or that being seems so very different from what we are today, right? What an enormous change has occurred. So don't they really look like these are two different people, that baby and what we are now? This is also like the change of the body. But when it is an event which we refer to as death, we begin to mourn about it. And that's what Krishna says. That seems to be an absurd thing to do. Let's forget about the natural process of aging. And if you were to look at people in the showbiz today, I mean, it's a really, really ridiculous and crazy trend which is going on, where almost everybody undergoes some form of surgery to their, you know, body to enhance it or make it more beautiful or make it more symmetrical. There are nose jobs, facelifts, cheek enhancements, tummy tucks, liposuctions, and any number of things like that. You know, I don't know why they would do that, but almost everybody goes under the knife to ensure that they enhance their features, right? And at the end of some people at the end of such surgeries look so very different as a person. But these are all changes that the body undergoes, but the dehi remains the same all the time. That person has undergone a change which is skin deep, but the person is the same, right? However much they might undergo this kind of a makeover through plastic surgery, the person remains the same. They could change the color of their skin. They could change the way their nose looks. They can completely change their hairline and do all these kind of things. But that person remains the same, right? The dehi does not change. All these changes are to the body. The dehi remains the same. The dehi is continuous. You may like one form more than the other. Like in the case of old age, we like the form which was younger than which is now. But in the case of probably a plastic surgery, you like a form which is now than what was before the surgery. But you may like one and not like the other. But the fact is, the dehi is continuous. It is only the deha which is undergoing the modification, right? So Krishna says, in the same way, the dehi changes a body. And when you say it changes the body, it's a complete makeover. You know, that's what it is. And that word literally means that. Dehantarana literally means getting an all new body. Rupantarana means change in the form. Dehantarana means getting a new body itself. So what you call the plastic surgery is, in Sanskrit, probably you'll have to use the word rupantarana. That's what is plastic surgery. I don't know what's the word for plastic. But the change of form in a small or a more elaborate manner. If rupantarana is a change of a certain form, dehantarana is also a change. Only here, the body itself has changed. It's a complete makeover of the body. It's only that we call the process death. And Krishna says, the dhiraha, or the truly wise, will not get deluded. Na muhyati. Moha means delusion. Muhyati means get deluded. So why does Krishna say deluded here? He's saying that if you are not able to recognize death as also a rupantarana, if you're not able to see death also as a process by which the external form is changing, you are being deluded. He says that this is also a very similar change, but it has only come in a different form. It has come in a different, through a different process. Let's say when you go for a job interview and, you know, you don't get selected for that particular job that you're applying for, either the panel can tell you directly that, look, you're not selected, we didn't find you qualified. Or most often what would happen is the panel or the people who are heading the panel will tell you that, you know, we see a lot of potential in you, but right now we don't have a portfolio or a position which is suitable for your qualifications and talents. So you know what, we'll get back to you. And if you're a wise person, you'll understand the real meaning of these words, right? If you're not a wise person, you'll think that they're going to get back to you and you'll be sitting and waiting for it. The same words can be told in a different way. A wise person understands the real meaning of those words, what we refer to as reading in between lines, right? And that's what differentiates a person who's wise or who's smart, right? Who's able to read between lines, who's able to speak more diplomatically and understand diplomatic words and expressions. The basis of this wisdom or that intelligence we're talking about is the words may be different, the expressions may be different, but you're able to sense what is the underlying message in both cases, right? So they're actually saying the same thing, but in different words, diplomatically. So if you're foolish, you will sit and wait thinking that they will call you, and then eventually you'll get dejected. But if you're smart, you'll pick the real meaning of those words. So even when we, you know, even when we are in school studying simple things like science or economics, who are those people who are really intelligent, whom we consider as intelligence? Those who can grasp concepts, and when a problem is given in the exam paper, they will be able to ensure, they will be able to make out this particular problem, which concept needs to be used. So the question might come in any number of forms. It may be different from how it appeared on your textbook or how it was given to you in your class. But if you're intelligent, if you've got a grasp of the concepts, you will know that this is the same concept, but it's just come in a different form, isn't it? In fact, that's precisely what we used to do in something as simple as addition and subtraction. When we were children, what would they do? They will teach us probably, you know, you have two pencils and I give you two pencils. And how many pencils do you have? You have four. So you have four pencils. I take one pencil from you. How many you have? It's actually basically they teaching you subtraction and addition. And tomorrow the teacher will come and tell you, okay, you have three apples, I give you one more apple, how many apples do you have? The child is, as it grows up, will sense that, you know, the form of the question is changing, but the concept is the same. That is what they're trying to teach the child. That is how we all underwent our training and understood concepts of mathematics, isn't it? And if that doesn't happen, you know, we would always have these hilarious moments with children. If you say that I give you four apples and I take one apple from you, and the child will say, I'll have three. So you have four mangoes, I take away two mangoes, how many you will have? The child will say, no, mangoes I will not give because mangoes I like. It's because the child is not still able to relate that it's only a problem which has been given to you so that you understand the concept. That's precisely what Krishna is telling you here. See, the forms in which this change is coming is different. That change appears like the change which happens from what we refer to as Kaumaram, Yavvanam, and Jara seems to be different from the change which happens with Dehantara Prapti or death or a complete makeover of the body when you get a new body. It looks like changes which are so different, but end of the day, it's like the same subtraction or addition problem which is coming in two different forms. If you are a smart person, you will realize that it's the same change. So Krishna is saying, did you cry when you became a boy from a child? Did you cry when you became an old man and a grandfather from a youth? Why do you have to cry when somebody passes on from this body to another body? So that is what Krishna is asking. So a wise man will recognize that it is just the same, but a different form. It is the same kind of change in a different form. And when not deluded, he or she will not feel sorrow or dejection. That's what Krishna is saying. This is the most important argument that Krishna is making. The other important thing about this particular verse is that, you know, it's quite logical, you know, when you talk of it like this, it seems like a very general thing, but we still cry over somebody dying. We still cry over some dear person not being with us anymore, right? That always happens. In fact, you talk about an individual, how many of us have still not been able to get over the fact that Swami is not physically with us? even though we know that Swami was always beyond the body, it's very easy for us to think that Swami is not the body. Here Krishna is saying that all of us are not the body, but at least it's easy for us to think that Swami is not the body, thanks to the many experiences of the omnipresence and omniscience that we have experienced with Swami. But still we grieve over that. So just by listening to this, it's not that tomorrow onwards our grief will go, right? But what Krishna is giving us through these verses is a very, very important lesson. Most often as we go through life, the spontaneous sorrow that we feel is a very, very accurate identifier or an indicator of where we stand in our maturity, in thinking maturity, in sense of our understanding of the philosophy of life. After all these discourses, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm doing this Bhagavad Gita program to present this program to you. I definitely have to read a little more than probably any of you will have to just listening to this program. But after all this, tomorrow if I'm struck with a disaster, I might break down. And when I break down, for me, it is an indication that, look, this is where you stand. This is not to put down ourselves. This is not to say that, oh, you speak a lot of philosophy, you're useless. That is not the approach. I'm saying that that spontaneous sorrow when we, what we feel is an indication of where we stand and what we have to work on. Where are our weak points and where we have to work. And that's precisely what has happened to Arjuna. Right? Arjuna is not a person who's scared of death, as we spoke last time. Arjuna has seen death. Arjuna, as a teenager, he lost his father. Arjuna is a warrior. He's seen many, many people die in front of him. But this was his weak point. The moment he feels that those who are closely related to him are going to die, and they're going to die through an action that he's going to perform, now he starts shaking in his fundamentals, right? So similarly, the sorrow that we experience in life as we go through the vagaries of life, vicissitudes of life, it is an indicator, a self-indicator for us to perform a self-audit and realize that this is where we have fallen or this is where we fall short. And there are many ways of dealing with sorrow, right? And the worst way of dealing with sorrow is probably to end one's life, to contemplate suicide. Another bad way of handling with sorrow is how people get into addictive habits, drinking or smoking, or they try to remain in that state of depression for as long as they can, because there is a certain amount of solace that comes when we are grieving, right? When somebody dies who is very dear to us, there is a certain amount of solace which comes with grieving, and we want to be in that depressed state. So people find all kinds of wrong ways of trying to extend it. But the smartest way to deal with sorrow is to deal by ruminating on such philosophy, right? That is why these verses are very, very important. Even as a standalone concept, these 10 or 20, 30 verses of the second chapter, if we are able to contemplate over and over again, our mental maturity will improve, our ability to deal with such disasters, such mishaps in our life will become better. Because none of us are going to escape all of this. I mean, death is the most certain thing of life. Losing somebody or having some kind of a failure, having some kind of a defeat in life is the most common thing all of us are going to face. So these are philosophical concepts which enable us to deal with these problems better. So that is why, observe yourself. If you are going through a problem, the sorrow that you face spontaneously is a tool for you to do self-audit. And when you're in sorrow, these are the ways by which you can come out of that sorrow by doing what Swami says, mananam. You take these concepts and you think about them over and over again till, you know, so that as the sorrow comes down, you are actually coming out of it in a much, much more mature manner rather than coming out hurt or coming out absolutely beaten down by the situation and things like that. So this is the 13th verse in the second chapter where Krishna says the change that happens from Kaumaram to Yavvanam to Jara is very, very similar to the change that happens at the time of Dehantara Prapti, or when you die and you get a new body. The wise one recognizes both of these changes as similar, and does not grieve over one and not grieve over the other. And that is the essence of that verse. We'll go to the next verse, the 14th verse. After that, I'll give you the brief meaning of that and we'll discuss about it.
Matra sparshastu kaunteya shitoshna sukha dukha da agama payino nityaha tanstitikshasva bharata.
The contacts of the senses with the objects, O son of Kunti, which cause heat and cold, pleasure and pain, have a beginning and an end. They are impermanent. Endure them bravely, O Arjuna. So that's verse number 14. This is again a very, very interesting, and Swami has himself spoken about this concept many, many times. Krishna says, Matra sparshastu shita ushna sukha dukkhadaha. Matraha. Matraha is a name given to the senses. The meaning of the word matraha actually is a measuring instrument. And the senses are called matraha, which means the senses are described as a measuring instrument. And I think in the 1990 Samukho series, which we had discussed as part of the first Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam season, we had extensively spoken about this. Swami refers to, there's one discourse entirely on the senses where Swami refers to this particular name that is given to the senses in Indian culture, matraha, which means a measuring instrument. Take for example a contraption or an instrument like thermometer. You know, we use the simple property of mercury. We've all studied this in our science and lower classes, where mercury has this property of expanding when exposed to heat or contracting when the temperature falls down. So we use that concept of mercury expanding and we put it in this particular, you know, capillary tube which has markings on it, and we use that to see whether what is the temperature, you know, either of a system or the temperature of the atmosphere, right? So we use the property of the mercury to see whether what is the weather or what is the temperature, right? So the contraption or the instrument as such does not feel anything. It does not feel hot or it does not feel cold. It is merely just doing what it is supposed to do. It has a property. The mercury has a property that it expands, and we are only using that property to find out the weather or the temperature. The instrument as such does not feel cold or hot in that sense, like what we understand it, right? Similarly, Swami says the sense organs are a measuring device. When they come in contact with the changes in the world outside, they tell you whether they are too intense or they are not, right? That's all is what the sense organs are meant to do. Take for example the eyes. Swami says, you know, it senses light. That's the basic function of the eye. It senses the intensity of the light that comes in. If the light is too bright or it is too dim, then the eyes begin to function accordingly. The eyes contract or it expand depending on the intensity of the light that is coming in. So is the faculty of smell. You know, when we eat food, we first smell the food and see if it is palatable or not. Because we know that the smell, we know what good food smells like, what healthy food smells like, right? And if it's a rotting food, then we say that, okay, this is not suitable for consumption. So in that sense, the nose actually is functioning as a measuring instrument. And many times, the evasive action or the protection against that is inbuilt into the system, right? Our eyes, as I said, they automatically contract or they expand based on the intensity of the light, or the eyelids have a certain function. Similarly, you know, when the skin senses the weather outside being too hot or too cold, it accordingly reacts. The act of sweating or the act of the skin becoming tight and becoming hard, all of that is an inbuilt response to what is the condition outside, right? But when we see the larger picture, sometimes we cannot avoid that situation completely. I'll just explain this. I don't know if I've been able to send it across clearly. The senses are a measuring instrument. There are changes happening outside. So the senses act according to the change. There are two roles the senses play. One is it senses the change outside. As simple as that. Whether it's too hot, too cold, too bright, too dim, it measures the intensity of the input which is coming. The second role it plays sometimes is the inbuilt reaction that it is supposed to take depending on the intensity of what is coming inside, right? So the senses are built that way. So when we look at us as a person and we look at our entire body as what we refer to as a combination of all these organ systems which involve all of these sense organs, when there is an unpleasantness outside, we are able to sense it through all of these things, through our sight, through our hearing, through our sense of what is happening outside us. All of that, we are able to make out that, okay, this is an unpleasant scenario, this is a pleasant situation, this is a favorable scenario, this is an unfavorable scenario. We are able to sense it, right? Moving away from there or going away from that particular scenario when it is unfavorable or unpleasant is not always an option. The option depends on our larger idea of what is the purpose of what we are trying to do. I'll try to explain this, make it a little simpler. Let's say I've chosen to be here in Prashanthi Nilayam. I've had this desire to be with Swami, so I've made this choice. I'm here at Prashanthi Nilayam. So that is the bigger reason for me to be here, let's say. There are some life goals, larger desires. And these have all propelled me and prompted me to take this decision to be in Puttaparthi and live in Prashanthi Nilayam and work here. We all know about the legendary summers of Prashanthi Nilayam. It becomes extremely hot. Even now it is like that. The 1.5-2 months in summer are pretty unbearable. Now that is an unpleasant scenario for me. That is an external scenario which becomes very unpleasant for me to accept. But that doesn't mean that I run away from that scenario every time it happens, right? Because I have a larger purpose to me being here. In my scheme of things, in my life, I have a larger importance and value that I place for this idea of me continuing to be in Puttaparthi. The unpleasantness of the external surroundings should not make me go away from here or try to run away from the circumstances, right? And that's precisely what Krishna is saying here. Matra sparshastu shita ushna. When the senses interact with the world, matra sparshastu means to touch, to interact with the world, you sense cold and hot. Shita ushna means cold and hot. And that creates a sense of pleasantness and unpleasantness as the case may be. Sukha dukkha daha. So when the senses interact with the changes outside, some changes are pleasant, some changes are unpleasant, or some changes are very intense, some changes are bearable, and based on that interaction of the senses with the outside world, you have these two emotions which raise, which are pleasantness and unpleasantness, or happiness and sadness. And this, Krishna says, is a very, very natural process. As I would always say in the answering booth when we are, dealing with many of the questions, the first and foremost important thing that we must do is we must acknowledge that this kind of a pain that we are undergoing whenever we are talking about problems in our life is a part of life. That acknowledging is a very, very critical part of problem solving. I've said this many, many times whenever we are talking about, having problems with our bosses or having problems in a family with our spouse or with mother-in-laws or brothers and sisters. I always say this, you have to first of all acknowledge that in a situation like that, it is quite natural to have these kind of skirmishes and this kind of unpleasant interactions with people. And just mentally making that as acceptable, acknowledging that this is a natural thing, is a very, very important part of solving that problem itself, right? So the first thing is we must acknowledge that it is part of life. This particular thing Swami has explained so very beautifully, this concept in one of the discourses in 1991 summer course. I, of course, remember that because we not long ago completed the 1991 summer course series, Shravanam, Mananam, Nirvidhyasanam. So in one particular discourse, Swami takes this very same concept which Krishna is explaining to Arjuna, that the senses is interacted with the outside world and it either feels cold or hot, and because of that it feels pleasant or unpleasant. I'll just read out those few lines which Swami has spoken there in 1991, June 1st discourse. I'll quote, and you will see how, you know, when I, in the introduction I said, we may or may not have gone through the Gita, but just the act of listening to Swami over and over again, we have understood many of these concepts. This is a clear example of that. You can see that Swami is saying the very same thing, but nowhere in the discourse Swami said that, just like how Krishna told Arjuna, or did not quote the verse verbatim. Swami says, the world has heat and cold, like people have joys and sorrows. Do we not dress according to the seasons? What is our summer apparel? It is a very thin fabric. When we visit a hill station, cold predominates. We cannot change the weather, but we wear thick clothes. We adjust to the weather and remain happy in all conditions. Similarly, during tough times, first accept the situation and then make efforts to get rid of the sorrow. Think of peace and joy when anguish dominates. Think of the bliss that follows difficulties. Develop such equal-mindedness, such wisdom to recognize what is temporary and what is permanent. Instead, if you want to have no difficulties in your life, is that ever possible? It is impossible to live without bad experiences. Grasp the significance of both good and bad experiences and cultivate the right attitude in each situation. End of quote. And what Swami explains in the next part of this, and what Swami explained in that passage that I read out, is what comes in the next part of the verse which Krishna is telling Arjuna here. He says, Agama Payina. Agama Payina means that which comes and goes. Agamana means to come, and Apayina means to go or vanish. So Agama Payina means that which comes and goes. Anityaha Tam Titikshasva Bharata. Krishna says, Anityaha Tam Titikshasva Bharata. Recognizing them as temporary, learn to tolerate them, is what Krishna tells Arjuna. Titiksha means tolerance or forbearance, or a form of higher way of dealing with changes which you may or may not like. So Krishna is telling very, very clearly here that things come and go, things happen and they vanish. They are anityaha, they are impermanent. Understanding them as impermanent, as I said, acknowledging that, yes, this is a difficulty, yes, this is unpleasant, but it is temporary. Acknowledging that, Tam Titikshasva Bharata, he says, you have to tolerate them. You always cannot choose to run away from an unpleasant situation. They will come and go, they are anityam or temporary, just tolerate them. Why? As I said, when you have a larger purpose, you must learn to tolerate what is unpleasant, which happens in between. Just like how, because I want to stay in Puttaparthi, I tolerate a bad summer, right? So first Krishna says, no one is going or coming in the verses that we went through last time. But definitely there is a change. He doesn't say that there is no change. He says there is a change. You didn't cry about the change that happened from childhood to old age. Similarly, death is also a change like that. And a wise, mature person will know that the change called death is also like other changes. And then Krishna says, some changes are more pleasant than some others. Those are like the changes we sense when the weather changes. We have to accept them, understand the pleasantness and unpleasantness as being temporary and then learn to endure them. Right? This is probably the summary of the past few verses that we've gone through. So there is a change, but we must learn to recognize them as temporary and learn to tolerate them. Now, while answering many questions in the answering booth on what Swami says about duty without love, especially there was one particular question where duty without love is deplorable. And I think in that context, I had the opportunity to talk about this to a small extent. On one hand, Swami says, avoid bad company. On the other hand, we are expected to dispense our duty even if the person we are duty bound to is unpleasant or bad. Right? So how do we reconcile these two? How do we balance these two out? In life, we need to balance it by, one is titiksha or forbearance, as explained in the words that we just heard, and the discrimination between good and bad. When it comes to avoiding bad company, we are talking about discrimination. When we talk about dispensing our duties even towards a person who is unpleasant or we are not very fond of, we are talking about titiksha. So when we speak of duty, when we are duty bound to a person or a situation, that becomes a situation or a time where tolerance and forbearance can be learned. But when we are not duty bound, that is a moment for us to use our discrimination. So, of course, even within duty, we are supposed to always use discrimination. I'm not telling that the moment, that's precisely the problem with Dhritarashtra. You know, he feels that he is duty bound to his son and he is completely bid farewell to his discrimination. Yes, within the duty also we must use our discrimination, but I hope you understand the difference between the two scenarios. Where our duty drives us, there it is an opportunity for us to practice and develop forbearance or titiksha. Where we are not duty bound, nobody is going to tell that you have to come to a bar, you have to come and do all of these nonsense, you have to come and smoke with us. We are not duty bound to do those things. There we use our discrimination and say that this is the right thing to do or this is the wrong thing to do and I will do this, I will not do this. Where we have the ability to make choices, which means almost every other place we have the opportunity, we use our discrimination. But sometimes we are duty bound, like in this case where Arjuna is duty bound to perform an action which is going to result in an unpleasantness. So Krishna is telling him, yes, I understand that, but if it results in unpleasantness, develop the titiksha to tolerate it. That's what Krishna is telling you. So your reaction cannot always be that of avoiding an unpleasant situation, right? Swami would say this, give this example, like when Swami speaks about the greatness of the tongue. Let's say you eat a mango, you take a bite of an apple, or you take a bite of a fruit. If that particular fruit is rotten, the tongue tastes that it is bitter and it immediately spits out. If it finds that it is sweet and if it is palatable, the tongue then allows the food to go in, right? So this is purely how the tongue functions. When you say that it is it is a measuring instrument, this is precisely how the tongue functions. It says that this is unpleasant, so I throw it out. This is pleasant, I take it in. But Swami also explains, let us say that you are sick. Let us say that you've been given a tonic and that tonic is bitter. It is unpleasant. In such a situation, you do not have the choice of spitting it out. The tongue is not given the choice of spitting out that unpleasant experience. There is the higher purpose of you having to become all right or curing yourself. So that higher purpose prevails at that particular point in time where even though it is unpleasant, you are expected to swallow that medicine, right? So that's precisely what Krishna is telling here, that you have to develop this titiksha, you have to develop this tolerance towards pleasant and unpleasantness because, you know, first he says the change is the same. It is coming in a different form. At one point you call it aging, at the other point you call it death, but it's nothing but the change. The Dehi is constant. You are a Dehi, I am a Dehi. All these men who have gathered here to fight are all Dehis. Nobody is going anywhere, he says. Yes, there is a change. Yes, some changes are unpleasant. You know, that's how Krishna puts it. There is a change. The change is the same. Fundamentally, it's the same change, but externally, some changes are pleasant, some changes are unpleasant. But when we are talking about having a higher purpose, then if it is an unpleasant change, you have to learn to tolerate it, right? And what happens when a person develops such tolerance? That is what Krishna explains in the next verse. I will not have time to go much into the detail of the next verse, but nevertheless, I'll play out the shloka. I'll give you the brief meaning. I'll give you a brief discussion after that. And the next week, probably, we'll start with this verse again, and we will begin our discussion from there. For now, it's verse number 15 of chapter 2. We'll listen to that.
Yam hi na vyathayantyete purusham purusharshabha samadukha sukham dhiram somrutatvaya kalpate.
O Arjuna, the prominent among men, the person whom these do not affect, who is the same in pleasure and pain, and who is discriminative, is fit for gaining liberation. So that's the meaning of verse 15. In this sloka, Krishna explains that what happens to one who is balanced and who's having discrimination, right? The word dhiram is actually a word with multiple meanings. Earlier, I think a couple of verses back, we spoke about Krishna using the word dhiraha. Dhiraha means one who is able to discriminate clearly or one who is intelligent. But here, dhiram is, of course, means somebody who is more stable and who is more composed. But it can also mean a much deeper sense of composure. I'll come to that. But in this particular verse in the beginning, Krishna is saying, yam hinav vyathayanti yete, he who is not disturbed or perturbed by these two, sama dukkha sukham, and remains the same in pleasure and pain, dhiram, who thus is steady in equanimity. Right? That is the description he says, that one who is not disturbed, one who considers pain and pleasure as same, and one who is a dhira, one who is able to remain stable in all of these. So what is this dhiram? As I said, one is to say that it is discrimination. The other way of looking at it is a kind of steadiness. But when we say dhiram is steadiness, it's not a slothful, tamasic steadiness. You know, even that will give you steadiness. If you don't react at all, if you don't take any interest in what is happening, that is also will give you a kind of a dhiram. But that is not what we refer to as dhiram, that steadiness which comes out of tamasic slothfulness. It is a steadiness that comes out of wisdom. When Krishna says, sama dukkha sukham dhiram, it means one who is patient and calm because he is wise, because he has wisdom. And it's not because he is slothful or he has fear or inability, right? That same discourse that I quoted some time ago, Swami makes another point which comes in the same passage, just follows that passage which I read out, where Swami explains this. I quote, it is impossible to live without bad experiences. Grasp the significance of both good and bad experiences and cultivate the right attitude in each situation. Such understanding and adjustment are most essential for students. Students have only misunderstanding but no understanding. They try to adjust externally with this flawed attitude. This causes bad reactions in them. So first cultivate understanding, then adjustment is easy and effortless. So very beautifully and so very clearly Swami explains that acceptance of pleasant and unpleasant happenings, joy and sorrow, pain and pleasure must come from understanding, not purely adjustment. You cannot directly go for adjustment without understanding. And what is that understanding that one must have? That they are agama payin. As I said, that they come and go, that they are transient, they are anityam. That should give you the understanding that this comes and goes, this is transient. That understanding should give you that dhiram, that steadiness, which is actually born out of wisdom, not out of weakness. So that is the the 15th shloka, and I wanted to speak a little more about that because there is a very important word which he uses, Krishna uses there, which is vyatayati. Vyatayati means to get disturbed. It'll need a little bit of time. I'll take that up next week. As I said, we'll start with this verse next week, and I'll explain a little more about this week, and we'll proceed with that. So I'll conclude with this particular verse, and I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. Dear listeners, thank you all for joining me. Do join me again next week. I will continue with the second chapter. As I said, these are verses. We may not be in a battlefield. We may not be in a position where we are fighting with uncles, grandfathers. But these are philosophies, concepts, and verses which are central to Vedanta. And as they always say, you know, these Vedantic concepts, constantly ruminating upon them, removes all kinds of fear, all kinds of despondency, right? That's precisely why Krishna is giving Arjuna that, because it has the fundamental ability to remove sorrow from us. So we all will be struck by sorrow. None of us are at a state where we're never going to be sorrowful at all. We will be struck by sorrow, as very beautifully Krishna has explained. The best way to overcome it is to understand that they come and go. They do not have a permanent nature, and the very fact that they come and go should make us feel that they are not worthy to be worried about. We'll take it on from there next week. Thank you all for joining me. I'm going to play for you a song. Tomorrow is Swami's birthday, and this is the latest release from Radio Sai as part of our Melodic series, Melodic Stories series. This is the one which we are releasing for Swami's 93rd birthday. Hum Tere Hai Sai. I'm going to play out that for you. After that, today we don't have the Vahini Satsang. It's a very, very busy time for all of us. Everybody is running around. Brother Bishu and Sai Prakash were not able to do the Vahini Satsang for you today. But nevertheless, Bishu has given me a talk of his, which I'll be playing. We had a wonderful drama this evening. As always, a convocation drama is centered around the theme of transformation. The talk I'm going to play for you, delivered by Bishu, is about how Swami has transformed many, many students who came to him through his love and through his beautiful and soulful interactions with the students. That's what the talk is going to be about. But before that, I'm going to play for you the Melodic Stories, the latest release from Radio Sai. You can download it from our website. It's available right now. And after that, you'll be listening to Brother Bishu's talk on how Swami transformed the students who came to him. I'll meet you all next week, 7:30 p.m. for the next episode of the Gita series, A Triune Pilgrimage. Happy listening.